Welcome into Opportunity Detroit. I'm Ann Thomas, and to kick off today's show, we're going to check in with Alana Rue, the president and CEO of the Detroit Historical Society. They're getting ready for their big Detroit Legends event. We'll also get an update on construction at the Gordie Howe International Bridge. And Grant Hilbers, the Windsor-Detroit Bridge Authority Chief Capital Officer, will join us. And the economic impact numbers from the draft are starting to come in, and they are amazing. Claude Molinari, the president and CEO of Visit Detroit, will have the details. An interesting show about great things happening in and around Detroit, coming up right after these messages. Welcome into Opportunity Detroit. I'm Ann Thomas, and to kick off today's show, we bring in Alana Rue. She's the president and CEO of the Detroit Historical Society. Alana, welcome to Opportunity Detroit.
Oh, thanks so much for having me, Ann.
And you know, speaking of Opportunity Detroit, I think we all need to take the opportunity to head over to the Detroit Historical Museum to check out all of these great exhibits. And you even have a new one. Tell us about it.
We do. Oh, my gosh. Well, Ann, as you know, we've been our region storytellers for, 103 years now. And we always have a lot going on, but May in particular is a big month at the Historical Museum. We're actually opening major exhibits at both museums. You know, you recall we also run the Dawson Great Lakes Museum, and we have our ball coming up. But just opening this weekend, we're really excited to be partnering with the Kresge Foundation and opening a new exhibition that's celebrating their 100th anniversary. And this exhibit takes visitors through the history of the Kresge retail area from the, you know, Kresge and Wilson Five and Dime all the way through the blue light specials of the Kmart era that we all remember. of course, the Kresge Foundation has just made such an incredible impact, you know, really across the country. People might not be aware of that. And so it tells the story of the family and the impact that the Kresge Foundation has been making. And it, I mean, it's really a wonderful opportunity. We've also have part of this, a once-in-a-generation update to the Kresge and Wilson storefront that's in our streets of old Detroit. That's, you know, it's really a fun way for people to just see how the store's evolved, you know, kind of in real time, in real place.
That is really cool. A lot of people, I know we always talk about the Kresge Foundation, but I bet a lot of people don't realize the great work that's been done there.
Well, it's amazing. It's, you know, over generations, it is literally every single state in the U.S. has benefited from their generosity, and people can explore all of that.
That's very, very cool. Now, you've also got the Detroit Legends event coming up. Can you talk a little bit about these legends and how this is going to work?
Yes. Well, we're super excited about this. So this is our annual society ball, which is going to be taking place at the museum. It's our cornerstone fundraiser on Saturday, May 11th, and tickets still are available. The evening is going to begin by welcoming to Legends Plaza, you know, which is sort of our Detroit Hollywood Walk of Fame, you know. But we're welcoming three new Detroit legends into that this year. Newscaster Huel Perkins, Spartan legend and Pistons announcer Greg Kelser, and also Detroit Red Wing player and broadcaster Mickey Redmond. So their hands and signatures will be installed on the plaza now for all time, and that's how we're going to begin the event. You know, it's our, as I said, our cornerstone event. The whole museum will be activated. It's a retro futurism theme because we are really looking forward at the next 100 years.
Wow, that's great. So can you tell us a little bit about some of the other interesting exhibits in the museum that people may want to come and take a look at during the spring, and especially during the summer when the kids are off, Alana?
Sure. Well, I'm going to start off, Ann, by touching on a couple things that are happening at the Dawson Great Lakes Museum. So on May 18th, we are opening an exhibit called Challenging These Waters in partnership with the Bayview Yacht Club. And it features the history of the famous Port Huron to Mackinac sailboat race that happens every July. So that's going to be a highlight in the museum for the next year. And, you know, we know how many people love going to Belle Isle. A lot of people kind of miss that the Dawson Great Lakes Museum is there. So we really really hope people will come out and join us right there on the river. But we're also, you know, we have other exhibits that are opening, a really spectacular exhibit telling the centennial story of Detroit Diesel is opening soon. We're telling the story of Z-Bart, and we have a really cool Detroit Pistons exhibition that is up now as well.
That's great. So let's focus on the Dawson Great Lakes Museum for a few minutes. Can you talk a little bit more about where exactly it is and what is featured in this museum? Because you're right, it's kind of, you know, tucked away.
It is. Yeah. Well, you know, we are on the Canada side of Belle Isle. So when you come in, as you're going around the circle on the Strand, we'll be on the right there. The Dawson Great Lakes Museum has been there since 1960, and it tells the maritime history, really, of the whole Great Lakes region. And it's just a wonderful little museum that is frankly pretty magical. You can pretend that you are piloting a freighter. You can learn the story of the Edmund Fitzgerald. We actually have the bow anchor of the Fitz on display, and a wonderful memorial to the sailors that lost their lives when the Fitzgerald went down. And really just learning about, the waterways and their importance to the founding of Detroit.
Yes, it'd be a great way to spend a summer day here in Detroit. And going back to the Detroit Historical Museum, what's the history behind the museum? How long has it been around? And I know since you've been in charge, you've made a lot of really interesting changes bringing history to life for people, Alana.
Oh, well, thanks, Anne. Yeah, I mean, gosh, I tell people all the time, I think I have the coolest job in Detroit.
you do.
And but being storytellers, it's so important, and it really is magical. We are changing exhibits all the time at the Historical Society. We had 19 different exhibits just in the past year. So people who think like, oh, I've been there, I've seen that, not true. You know, please come back. But the Detroit Historical Society was founded 103 years ago. The Detroit Historical Museum, however, didn't open until 1951. And then there was, in 1960, a significant addition was put on that, you know, doubled the space of the museum. And we've been working really hard to ensure that we are telling everyone's stories. You know, it's something we take really seriously, that we are the only museum in our region that is responsible really for telling the stories of everyone who lives here. So those are very diverse. We have a fabulous exhibit right now called Life on Hastings Street, which we're doing in partnership with the Jewish Historical Society, that talks about the Jewish people that really founded the area of Black Bottom and Paradise Valley and how that changed over the years. We have opportunity really to partner with organizations and groups whose stories might not be told elsewhere.
And it's really cool how it's laid out. You can kind of walk around like you're walking around the streets of Detroit.
Yes. Well, I mean, that exhibit in particular on our lower level, it's like if you grew up in Detroit and you remember going there as a third grader. And, you know, it surprises me. Some people are like, I haven't been here since then, you know, but it's pretty much the same. That's one of those things, we don't dare make changes there very often. But we have recently updated. We've added QR code powered interpretation. So if you're in the streets of old Detroit, it'll still feel like it did, but you can take out your phone and, watch some videos and learn much more in depth about the individual stores that are featured there. It's really, there's something always changing and different. And if folks haven't been down in a while, the summer would be a great time to do so.
Now, I know this is kind of like asking a mom, who's your favorite child, but I'll ask, what is your favorite exhibit? What do you like the most?
Oh, my gosh. I can't really pick, but I think the most impactful thing that we've done in our history is to tell the story of the uprising in Detroit in 1967.
Yes.
You'll recall, Anne, I know you guys are really involved at JR in helping promote that. And when it opened in 2017, And, you know, that tells a critical story of, you know, how Detroit has changed over the years. And at the time that that opened, it was supposed to be a temporary exhibit that would be around for a couple of years. And since I came on board here in 2018, we realized that it's just too important. And it, so it became the first new permanent exhibit at the Historical Society in years. So we're making some relevant updates to that right now, too, though, coming up here in the next little bit to bring the story forward to modern times and all of the things that happen with race relations in the city since then.
Speaking of our city and how it has developed over the years, it must be really fun for you to see all the great things happening in and around Detroit, Alana.
Oh, well, it is. And one of the things that we take, you know, also really seriously is that it's our role to also collect the stories that are, as they're being made now, history in the making. And so, in fact, over the last couple of days, we've had our team from our curatorial and collections department working with the Detroit Lions and Visit Detroit and the DDP to collect artifacts from the draft.
Oh.
And, you know, people don't think about that, and a lot of the stuff would have just been thrown away. You know, like, you don't really, it's not going to happen again. So we were really grateful to the leadership of those organizations that reached out and let us kind of get behind the scenes to save these items. And so we're hoping that they will be on display in the not too distant future here.
Well, you know, that's really fascinating. What are some of the items that you were interested in that you were able to get?
You know, it's funny. They just picked him up this morning, so that's hot off the presses. I'm not even sure exactly, you know, what we have. I know that some of the things that are interesting, though, are the things that not everyone could get. So, you know, kind of anything from that simple from, like, the behind-the-scenes passes. You know, the VIP passes and things like that, any of the promotional materials,
like signs.
But then, you know, also sort of these big props that we all saw. I mean, I didn't go down there, but, you know, that we all saw on TV, you know, the countdown clock and, you know, the stuff that was in Campus Martius and some of the experiential things that people, you know, were able to participate in. So I know that our team was able to collect some of those things, and we're just going to have to wait and see, because I don't even know yet.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I just did a draft wrap-up for our company, and we have a lot of really cool things that I want to save, too. You know, like, we have a countdown, and Mark Blackwell, our production director, did these incredible 60-second promos where we had our talent welcome Detroiters to the city and then give them advice about what to go and do. And a lot of them recommended, you know, food and fun activities. But, you know, those are things to save, too, because this was really a once-in-a-lifetime thing for many people.
It was, yeah, absolutely. You know, you have to imagine that because we did so well with this, that somewhere down the line, who knows how many years later, there'll be another draft that happens here. And so, you know, that's another reason why contemporary collecting, as we call it, is so important, because people are going to say, oh, you know, remember that, right? And we'll be able to pull these things out and remind people about what it was like during this time.
And, you know, finally, you say you have the greatest job, which it is a really fun job. But what is it about this job that you love? I mean, is there something in particular, or is it just bringing history to life?
Well, it's a great question. There's a lot of things. You know, history is really important. And, you know, a lot of people kind of take it for granted. But as we know, it informs the future. And so one of the things I love is watching little kids walk around the museum and see stories of the past that can inspire them, you know, of what they could be in the future. You know, caring for the city's collection of artifacts, there are almost 300,000 artifacts that are important to our region that we take care of in an old World War II era building that's out at historic Fort Wayne. And, you know, that responsibility is really pretty amazing and magical. But I think it's, you know, too, just the opportunity to ensure that this institution that's so important is going to be here 100 years from now.
Yes.
And, you know, so of course, like all nonprofits and museums around the world, we're struggling financially in sort of this post-COVID world. We're pursuing a millage in partnership with the Charles H. Wright. And, you know, should that come to fruition, we would be changing the trajectory of this institution for all time. And what an amazing legacy that would be. I would be so proud to say that I was part of a team that was able to make that happen.
Absolutely. Now tell us where the museum is. I know you talked about the Dawson Great Lakes Museum, but explain to our listeners where to go. And I know you have a good website. They should go check out the website, donate.
They should,
figure out how to get there.
Absolutely. Yep. DetroitHistorical.org. And you can find us on social just by looking up Detroit Historical. But we are right on Woodward, 5401 Woodward, at the corner of Kirby. And we are just across Kirby from the public library. And we're, you know, we're in the vibrant cultural district and a kitty corner from the DIA. And, you know, we love bringing, you know, having people come down to the cultural district and visiting more than one of the amazing places that we have down in Midtown.
Alana Rue, President and CEO of the Detroit Historical Society, thanks so much for your time today. It was great talking to you.
Oh, great to catch up, Ann. Thanks for having me.
Coming up next on Opportunity Detroit, we'll find out how construction is coming along at the Gordie Howe International Bridge. We'll be right back after these messages. You are listening to Opportunity Detroit, sponsored by Rocket Mortgage. I'm Ann Thomas, and here in the Golden Tower of the Fisher Building, we can see the beautiful Gordie Howe International Bridge coming to life. So we thought it would be a good time to find out exactly how this construction is coming along. We found the perfect person to do it. He is the Windsor-Detroit Bridge Authority Chief Capital Officer, Grant Hilbers. Thank you for joining us today.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Grant, tell us a little bit about the project. In late March, you celebrated 2,000 days of construction. What does it look like right now?
So, and it is amazing that we've hit 2,000 days of construction on this project. So we are in our fifth year of construction. As of now, the two towers, the one in Canada and the U.S., they've both reached full height, and that happened last year. The two towers are 722 feet high,
wow,
which is just slightly lower than the center building in the Renaissance Center. So it's these towers really do change the skyline of Detroit and Windsor.
Yeah, they're beautiful. The morning show is constantly talking about how when your project is finished, they would like to broadcast from the towers. Now, I'm afraid of heights, so that doesn't sound too fun to me, but they're all over this idea.
Yeah, that might be a little challenging, but we certainly can work with you.
So what else is coming? What's the next big part of this project?
Well, the next big milestone is going to be connection of the bridge, which we expect to happen in the next few months. So I think people in this area have seen progress across the water, but we're only a handful of segments away from that final connection.
Wow.
Which will be just a milestone event for this project. Some of us have been waiting years to achieve this, we're quite happy that it's happening. I should note that once the connection's made, there is still quite a bit of work that has to be completed, both on the bridge and the two ports of entry, entry in either country. So we still don't expect traffic until the fall of 2025, but that connection of the bridge certainly is a milestone in this project.
Well, I know absolutely nothing about bridge construction, so I would like you to start from the beginning. You're an engineer. How in the world do you make this connection? How do you build the actual bridge and do it safely? Wow.
Well, and certainly safety is one of our absolute priorities on this project. So this kind of bridge was built first on the land portion. So the portion landward side from the towers was constructed on temporary supports. So that whole thing was put together. Once that was done, we started over the water. So this is sometimes called a stick build, but it works segment by segment over the water with 27 segments from each country, finally meeting in the center. Each of those segments was constructed with steel. Precast concrete panels were placed on top and stitched together with concrete, and cables are connected. And that's been repeated over and over 27 times, or almost 27 times, from each country, eventually meeting. So two separate crews are working, and we'll meet in the center, which requires a lot of coordination, some very complicated survey equipment on the bridge to make sure everything connects perfectly. And all that information is fed to a group of bridge engineers on a daily basis to make sure that everything is lining up and perfect. But it takes quite a bit of work, a lot of very skilled labor from both countries, as well as a small army of engineers.
Yeah, I mean, it's really incredible to me that it can even be done. So how deep is the water there? And do the beams go down into the water, or how does this work?
So both of the towers on the Gordie Howe International Bridge are located on land.
Okay.
And that was a deliberate decision made years ago during planning, both to make sure that we didn't impact shipping, because this is a major shipping corridor for supporting both of the countries, and also to make sure that we didn't impact any of the fisheries in the water. So having them located on land means that the Gordie Howe International Bridge will be the longest cable-stay bridge in North America once constructed. Not by a little bit. It's 40% longer than the second longest bridge. So The clear span between the two towers is about half a mile.
And how many different people and crews, like what are some of the crews that would be involved in this project?
So we've got crews from various unions. So we've got iron workers working on the bridge, but we also have two ports of entry. So you name the trade, and we've got them involved on this project. More than 11,000 workers have gone through orientation on this project, 42% of which are from the local area. And an amazing 12 million hours have been worked on this project to date. So that is just a testament to the number of hands that have been involved in constructing this amazing project.
What are some of the more interesting things to you as an engineer about this project? What do you think listeners would find fascinating?
I think, you know, if anybody came here when we were constructing the tower, one of the very interesting things is the form that we were constructing the tower with actually lifted with the tower. And it started, the towers are A-shaped, so you've got two legs at the bottom, and then they come together to the upper pylon portion. And those forms moved up the entire time, and those forms were three levels high. All of the work to construct this tower was completed in there, and then the forms lifted themselves up, eventually coming together into a single form for the top section. So just the construction engineering that went into to build something like this is actually fascinating.
I'm sure you watched with interest when there was the mishap recently with regard to the ship crashing into the bridge. It probably made you cringe.
The overall and any infrastructure impact like that does make me cringe as an engineer. We have designed this bridge so that kind of impact wouldn't impact our bridge. Having the towers on land, plus having some provisions along the shoreline, that was actually considered as we figured out this design. So this bridge is safe from bridge impact or boat impact.
Which is huge, because as you point out, this is a main shipping channel.
This is a major shipping channel, you know, serving both the countries. I think it's maybe the busiest freshwater channel. Not to mention that this corridor is the busiest corridor for land-based trade between the two countries, which is one of the reasons why this bridge is being constructed.
And as a longtime resident of Windsor, how do you feel about this incredible project taking shape?
It's amazing to be part of this once-in-a-generation project. It's been nearly 100 years since a crossing between Windsor and Detroit has been built. So this opportunity, once-in-a-generation opportunity, I didn't think would be possible when I was going through school, so I'm just ecstatic to be part of this project.
Have you been involved in other bridge projects, Grant Hilbers?
I have not. I'm a civil and environmental engineer by training. I was involved in various projects leading into this, and I came on the project 7 years ago. I've got a lot of people that have bridge expertise. I've got a lot of a team of engineers that I can dip into, but this is the first bridge project I've worked on.
You know, and I can imagine that the environment would have to be taken into consideration when you're doing this kind of a project. Can you talk a little bit about that?
So environmental stewardship and community benefits have been key tenets of this project from day one. We've incorporated a number of environmental and sustainability initiatives into especially the ports of entry. So we've got some green roofs in the ports of entry, native planting, stormwater controls that are modern and friendly to the environment. In addition, when I talk about communities, there's a $23 million community benefits package.
Wow.
And one of the outstanding features of this bridge is there's a multi-use path that crosses it that will be free of charge. We haven't set tolls for the bridge yet, but we have announced that pedestrians and cyclists using the bridge, that will be free of charge.
That's interesting, the community benefit package. Does that mean that the communities around the bridge will see improvement because of this incredible project, Grant?
Yes, and that is what the community benefits, the $23 million community benefit package is dedicated to, specifically the communities directly impacted by construction of the bridge. For example, there have been approximately 100 homes in the Delray community that have benefited from that through enhancements, windows, and roof replacements. All of that money is really intended to improve the communities and you know, compensate for, you know, the impact of construction all these years.
Sure. Wow, that's a great idea. Is there anything else that you want our listeners to know? The opening, you say, is fall of 2025, you think?
Yeah, opening to traffic will be fall of 2025. Everybody's going to see a bridge connected and wondering how quickly it can be completed. But we do have two ports of entry. So
it's a big deal.
Each of the ports of entry is the largest port along the land port along the Canadian-U.S. border. So we have a connection to I-75, providing highway-to-highway connectivity for this bridge. So we basically have four mega projects in one. So wrapping those up from the time the bridge closes will take a little bit of time, but it'll come before anybody notices, and we'll have this in service.
Absolutely. Grant Hilbers, Chief Capital Officer for the Windsor-Detroit Bridge Authority. Now, we're going to check back with you later in the year just to see what you think, how it looks, and you can remind people that we need a little bit more time, but we're getting closer every day.
Absolutely. I'm always happy to talk about this project.
Absolutely. Thank you for the time today. Coming up next on Opportunity Detroit, the draft cleanup is just about finished, but the economic impact of this great event will be felt for a very long time. We'll get the details right after these messages. You're listening to Opportunity Detroit, sponsored by Rocket Mortgage, and I'm Ann Thomas. The draft in Detroit has ended, but it has left a lasting impact on the city and the surrounding area. Claude Molinari, the president and CEO of Visit Detroit, is here with us now to talk about this impact. Wow, Claude, I still can't believe it. Everybody is talking about what a great job you all did in Detroit.
Well, there were so many people, and first of all, thank you for having me on your program. So many people involved in making this a success. I mean, you know, I feel somewhat ridiculous taking any credit because we had so many people from the city of Detroit, from Rocket Mortgage, from the DDP, to all our donors and sponsors, the police department, the fire department, Wayne County. I mean, everybody contributed, and certainly I also give a huge hats off and MVP status to the citizens of Detroit and Southeast Michigan, who were just incredible hosts to all the thousands of people that came to visit.
So when we talk about impact, let's first of all just talk about how this will impact you. Visit Detroit. I have a feeling an awful lot of people are now going to visit Detroit, Claude.
Oh, there's no question. And I'm hearing from my counterparts and competitors throughout the country that you basically guys just had a 72-hour infomercial on Detroit on national broadcast where it was just a total love fest. Everybody talking about how beautiful the city was, new all these skyscrapers, all this new construction, that beautiful, pure blue Michigan water, you know, on the river there. I mean, just incredible. And I think this platform, this national and international spotlight on this city for this particular draft, setting the all-time records, I believe that this is going to pay dividends for our tourism industry for years to come, like a decade. They'll still be talking about, I saw this, I saw the draft, I saw how incredible that city looked, I had to come and visit.
And I also know how important the convention business is for you. I have a feeling that will help with the convention business too.
Oh, no doubt. We're already receiving inquiries. In fact, we had a group from the UK that came in on the last day of the draft, and they were blown away, and they couldn't believe how the city was in such incredible form. And again, I think that across the country, I'm actually headed to, this weekend I'm heading to Los Angeles for a international trade conference where group travel comes from across the world. And we were about 95% filled with all our appointments. We're now 130% filled. A bunch of people are doubling up to meet with our group, and we're thinking of bringing another person just to meet the demand for the people who want to meet with us and start booking group tours to Detroit and Southeast Michigan.
Wow, that's incredible. Now, I know all of the economic impact numbers are not in yet, but you do have some very impressive hotel occupancy numbers. Talk about that, Claude Molinari.
Well, across Southeast Michigan, the entire region, we were at 92% occupancy on Thursday night, the first night of the draft.
That's
amazing. We were over 80% the day before, the day after, and then on the Saturday as well. So, you know, when you look at it, like Taylor Swift, during the summer, we were at 81 and 83% occupancy. So you can just see, like, the NFL draft on that first night was well over 90%, and that's incredible and such a huge boost to the region. And again, I think that whenever you're above 60%, the hotels are profitable. So when you're at 90%, the hotels are doing really well. And it's important, you know, it's important for Detroit entrepreneurs to do very well. And I think one of the unsung, you know, parts of this draft is, you know, we had over 500 stagehands, union workers, building out all the theatrical and pieces in the amphitheater. We had electricians, we had teamsters, iron workers, and then over 800 Detroiters were employed as teammates for the NFL draft. And, you know, the NFL doesn't do volunteers. Everyone has to be paid to work on this. They call them teammates. So who historically would be volunteers who would love to be a part of this, were actually paid, and it was a living wage. So again, there's so many people who benefited from this, including more than 60 Detroit businesses that got contracts to work on this event with the NFL. And we're talking not just like, oh, boutonnieres on the jackets. We're talking about flowers, furniture, food, equipment, logistics. So really great stuff for a lot of our entrepreneurs.
Well, you know, I think the idea of going local like that, Claude, was part of the magic.
Oh, no doubt. And again, I think, you know, there was a few things we were like, there's two things that we really wanted to make sure of. Number one was that Detroiters were involved,
yes,
that this was going to be inclusive, and that we would be failing in our mission if we do not make sure that Detroit businesses benefit. And if we could have minority businesses, even better. Like, we wanted to make this, give people a boost, because sometimes all it takes is one big contract to push a business to the next level.
That's
and so we really feel that there's some people that, you know, talked about how, like, they got a month's worth of work or 2 months worth of work, you know, or profit out of just this event. And, you know, and the second thing, of course, was we wanted to make sure that it was inclusive for everybody, that everybody felt welcome, and that we're going to spread it around the city so that, you know, if you couldn't get inside the footprint of Campus Martius and Cadillac Square, that Beacon Park, Capitol Park, Harmony Park, Greektown, they were all activated and would have video and audio, large screen video and audio. So wherever you were during the draft, you could still be a part of it in the same way. And that wasn't the case in other cities. And we wanted to make sure that on those two counts, that we would not get any complaints.
What were some of your favorite moments over the entire weekend?
Well, you know, I think Thursday night when the commissioner announced the draft was on, I mean, that was an amazing moment. Certainly the national anthem and the jets flying overhead was you know, those kind of moments that are just brilliant. I had a personal great moment. I announced one of the draft picks on Saturday. And what was interesting is, you know, in previous drafts, you know, I had visited, you know, on the Saturday when people are making the picks, they're making, you know, like you're making the 150th pick or the 200th pick in the draft. You're doing it in front of an audience of 50 or 60 people. And when I came out on the stage Saturday after 4 p.m., and there was the better part of 200,000 people, like, looking at me up there, I was like, this is surreal. Like, this is unbelievable. And, of course, then at the end when the final, Mr. Irrelevant was chosen, the very last pick of the draft, I was sitting in a seat just outside the stage area with my wife, and I will admit, I shed a tear of like, oh, my goodness, like, what an amazing, we got it done, and everything was fantastic, and, you know, there was no incidents, and so those were truly some of those moments where you're just, you know, very thankful.
Absolutely. So what's next for you this summer? What are some of the other big events that you are going to be very involved in, Claude Molinari?
Well, we have a couple of big ones. I mean, we're going to be hosting the National Guard for two different events.
Oh, wow.
So we've got they'll bring in about 10,000 active and reserve National Guards, people who are going to be coming to the city for several weekends. And then we've also have the Professional Conference Meeting Association, or PCMA, EDUCON event. And that won't matter to a lot of Detroit local people who aren't involved in the industry, but these are going to bring 1,200 meeting planners, and these meeting planners will again get a view of the city and all that's going on here. And we're hopeful that, you know, even if only 10% of those 1,200 meeting planners were to book a business in here,
sure,
you know, that's 12 major events.
Wow.
And we're thinking that, again, as we introduce more and more people to Detroit, especially meeting planners, the people that put on conventions, they will decide this is a great place to bring an event. So this event is going to be awesome. We're going to show these meeting planners everything that Detroit has to offer, and as well as Novi. And we're hoping that we're going to get a lot of business out of it for future years.
Absolutely. And I know the Final Four is about, is it 1,000 days away? But what the heck? Let's start talking about it now.
Yeah. Yeah, it's funny. We have our countdown clock going,
and
we've already got a request to put somebody else on the clock for an upcoming event. But we're excited. I mean, again, I'm so thrilled. We have the Detroit Grand Prix coming right up, and right after that, we have the Rocket Mortgage Golf Classic, which is incredible. Even and before that, over Memorial Day, we have Movement Fest, which, we can't really book any big events in the convention center that on Memorial Day weekend, because the Movement Fest takes all the hotel rooms, which is fantastic.
Right. And we've got the Ford Fireworks.
Oh, I know.
That's
going to be a
deal.
Great night. And, you know, Tony Michaels and the parade company do such an amazing job, and we'll be bringing in some people from out of town. I'm sorry, you know what? We've got that PCMA EDUCON is on there, and I'm telling those guests that we're doing it just for them.
I love it. Well, Claude Molinari, President and CEO of Visit Detroit, thank you so much for your time today. It was really great to talk to you.
My pleasure, Ann. You're the best.
So are you. And I'm Ann Thomas. Thank you for listening to Opportunity Detroit. Enjoy the rest of your day.